and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And also, good morning. It's Friday, so welcome to the show on this wonderful Friday morning. The weekend is almost here, and it's been a really eventful week here in Canada, and no doubt, wherever you are, you've probably heard the shocking news about the attacks in Ottawa that have left, as of this time of recording, one person dead, possibly more injured. We'll discuss that a little bit later on in the show. But first, we have our interview with Paula Spivak of Volunteer Canada. And we'll be speaking with Paula about volunteering, but specifically about employer-supported volunteering, which is a concept that's getting a lot of traction in the workforce these days. Paula is the author of a new report on the role of volunteering in the workplace entitled Employer-Supported Volunteering, The Practice and the Promise of Community Engagement. So we'll have a link in our show notes to that article that you can read, and then tune in for the interview with Paula, where we discuss in more detail what this actually means for volunteers in the workforce today, and also what it means for the nonprofit sector as well. So stay tuned. We'll have that interview right after our first break. We also have some more news on the CRA and the ongoing charity audits of progressive charities. Lots more to discuss on that front as well, including a special event that's coming up here in Vancouver. If you're a local, you can come and attend it, and you'll actually see me there. I'm going to be hosting this event, and it sounds like a lot of fun. It's going to be very thought-provoking, so we'll have more details on that as well. And like I said, let's take a quick little break here on The Sector, and we'll return after this. Stay tuned.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca. Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure,
that's what friends are for. Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We're back on The Sector here on CITR. Let's go on to our interview with Paula Spivak. Joining us now is Paula Spivak of Volunteer Canada. Paula also recently wrote a report on volunteering in the workforce entitled Employer-Supported Volunteering, The Practice and Promise of Community Engagement. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you. It's great to be here talking about something so important as employee volunteering.
So let's start off with Volunteer Canada. What does the organization do, and what's your role with them?
Volunteer Canada helps Canadians and communities reach their potential through volunteering. And we do that in a number of ways, but essentially we strengthen the network and work with all the players. So that would be nonprofit organizations that engage volunteers, businesses that encourage employees to volunteer, schools that encourage students to volunteer, public policy departments that facilitate that, and just the general community that benefits and participates in that. My role with Volunteer Canada is with the president and CEO, and I work with a great leadership team and a great board of directors to strengthen volunteering.
And tell us a bit about the report that you authored on employer-supported volunteering. What is it, and why is it important, and what were the findings from the report?
The whole area of employer-supported volunteering is becoming increasingly important for a number of reasons. One is that people want to go to work with their whole self, and that is their values and their passion and the things that they care about, as opposed to having to see that as something separate. And with busy lives, the more we can integrate the various parts of ourselves, the easier it becomes. Secondly, employers are seeing that in order to attract top talent, they really need to be very explicit about how a person can express their values and contribution to community as part of their workplace, and what kind of employer they're going to be associated with. What are the values and practices of a company, and do they feel proud of it, and do they want to promote that in all areas of their life? So it's becoming really important, and when you consider the fact that of the 13.3 million Canadians who are volunteering, over 5 million of them said that they get in some sort of support from their employer, and that is growing.
So, and you mentioned the volunteer rates here in Canada, very high, almost 50%. What do you think accounts for this level of volunteering in Canada?
In Canada, as in other regions of the world, people are naturally generous, and it's human nature to want to respond to the things that you see around you, to want to make your community, your neighborhood better than you know it was when you got there, and to just to have purpose and make a difference in the world. So I think those things are human nature, and that's universal. In Canada, one of the things that we also consider when we look at volunteering is it's a way to participate in democracy. It's a way to shape the communities that you want to live in, that you want to leave for future generations. And so in addition to all the really amazing work people do in direct service, volunteers also have a huge impact on the quality of life, on the policies, on the way we think about participation and connection to community. So I think that's part of why the context in Canada really is broader than many may realize, in that we're looking at volunteering as a very powerful form of citizen engagement and, as I said, a sense of belonging, a sense of connection, and a way to express citizenship.
And do you think that we've reached sort of a maximum capacity, or are there ways to get more people involved and to encourage more volunteering across the board in Canada?
It's always great to increase the numbers of volunteers, but one of the things that Volunteer Canada is very interested in is increasing and improving the quality of the volunteer experience. And that's not to suggest that there is a widespread dissatisfaction. There's an amazing level of volunteering, and many people do it year after year. But at the same time, we also know that there's somewhat of a gap between what people are looking for in volunteering and how organizations are currently engaging volunteers. And so we're working with individuals to look at things in a broader context, but we're also working with organizations to consider broadening their definition, making their organizations more inclusive, looking at a whole range of ways that people could participate rather than what they've been doing traditionally. That's, again, not to suggest that they discontinue things that have worked and that are very important, but to look at short-term opportunities to contribute to the capacity of the organization, for example, by facilitating a strategic planning day, by reviewing some policies, and by perhaps being available to be an executive coach for a new executive director in a small nonprofit.
And on that same subject, the question of employer-supported volunteering comes into play. So based on your report, what are some of the ways that an employer can support employee volunteering and make an impact?
there's a whole range of benefits to volunteering through a workplace, and a whole range of approaches to supporting that. So it could be something very organized, such as in a workplace or an employer organizing group volunteering activities, perhaps getting together and partnering with a specific organization and doing specific projects with groups of employees. It could also be something from a policy point of view, where an employer will say that they will provide certain amount of time off during the workday each month or each year for an employee to be able to volunteer in an area that they choose. Another way to support and follow the interests and values of an employee is by making donations to the charitable organizations where employees volunteer. And that's another way to support and encourage and recognize that. Sometimes it could also be practical ways, so allowing an employee who's on a board of directors to use the boardroom for a board meeting, or for some kind of activity to take place if an organization or a company does have either reception space or other kinds of equipment that's useful for an organization. So there's a whole range of ways that employers can support, either formally or informally by policies and so on.
Right. And so when the employer supports the employee for volunteering, it can be through like a work-sponsored volunteering program, or it can just be in general having a system in place so that volunteers can volunteer wherever they like. And ultimately, this impact will affect the willingness of the employee to volunteer. So what kind of effect can this have? Are we talking about more volunteering or more dedicated volunteering, like you were talking about with finding the right fit?
It definitely makes volunteering more accessible to people who are working, especially those who also have families and other kinds of responsibilities in their life. This is a way to integrate that. In fact, many companies are offering family volunteering opportunities so that not only can an employee volunteer through their company, but they may be able to do it with members of their family, and that's an opportunity to have quality time with family members to transfer values, but also it doesn't take the person away from their family at a time when they want to be spending that time when you're talking about, for example, evenings or weekends. So that's one benefit is the integration. The other impact it can have is helping people see each other in a different light. So, for example, in a company, you may have different roles. There may be a structure where some people are in management positions and other people are doing frontline work. When you're volunteering together, you see each other as people. You see the qualities that you have, and you get to know each other on a different level. And so when you're back in the workplace, it really does enhance that kind of communication. So there's, of course, benefits, and I think we're going to get into that in a few minutes, but by employers supporting volunteering and supporting their employees to volunteer, it not only increases the numbers, but it makes it more accessible, and it makes it possible for them to align the volunteering with either personal values or professional development goals in a very immediate way. So it improves the quality of it.
Right. And I was looking at your report. There's a section where companies respond to what Canadians think is important factors for volunteering. Now, there's a bit of a discrepancy between what the companies consider important and what actual Canadians consider important. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Certainly. As you've probably heard from various companies and organizations, that it's become much more common for companies to develop priorities or theme areas when it comes to not only where they organize employees to volunteer, but also with respect to donations and sponsorship. And that is probably a good thing in terms of being able to have a greater impact when you integrate the various ways of contributing to community. The downside to that can be that those employees who have other interests and other causes that matter to them, or those organizations that don't happen to fit into those priorities, can feel left out. And that's one of the reasons why we encourage and really support those companies that also have that flexibility we were talking about. On one hand, the organized activities can go hand in hand with some of the themes that have been identified, but also supporting employees to follow their own interests. And that's part of the way that you can handle that gap that you're referring to. There are also, of course, many areas where absolutely people are in sync, Canadians are in sync in terms of what they thought was important with respect to the kinds of issues that companies undertake. Youth is a good example where certainly the public agrees that services to youth and youth engagement is important, and many companies have established youth as a priority.
And in terms of the employees themselves, there's a lot of reasons why they volunteer, and we've talked a bit about that already. But what about the employers? What are they benefiting in terms of allowing their employees to, you know, take time off work to go and volunteer? How does it come back and benefit them?
And this is an area that we're becoming more and more aware of, and a lot of research really has demonstrated these concrete benefits. So I talked about the ability to recruit top talent, that a company that has a strong corporate social responsibility program that also includes an employee volunteering program has a better chance of recruiting people and retaining them because of their sense that they are being associated with a company that is seen to be caring and is a vehicle through which they can express those values. Employee engagement, so employees that are involved in the employee volunteering program tend to have an increased level of engagement with the company and participate in other areas as well. Employee morale, when you look at the energy you get when you're participating in something that is valuable and contributes to the community or makes a difference in someone's life, that really has a very positive effect on your individual well-being, but collectively, to feel that collectively you are making a difference in a community certainly has a positive effect on morale. The other interesting area is from a human resource point of view. If you look at volunteering as a vehicle for skills development and professional development, then the benefit here is you can tie in your performance objectives with the volunteer experiences. So as an example, if someone is interested in improving their leadership skills or their ability to coordinate logistics, it's easy to find a volunteer opportunity that can develop those very skills. So that's another really great benefit to a company in that the skills development is great individually and collectively, so increased performance overall.
And are there any particular industries that are doing this very well that perhaps either was surprising for you, or you just thought, wow, this industry has really got this and they're really, you know, running with this idea and doing great things with it?
Well, one of the really neat things about looking at the different programs in employer-supported volunteering is it really is in all industries. You find that the financial industry tends to have a very comprehensive program in terms of policy and organized activities and a recognition program, as does the energy industry in terms of looking at community engagement and employee engagement and opportunities to contribute to the community. So if you're looking for big corporations, such as the retail industry and so on, that many of these companies do have very comprehensive practices and programs. Having said that, when you look at small and medium-sized enterprises, they may have less structured programs. However, they're as involved and contributing as much on a per-person basis, if not more, because they tend to be small and flexible and somewhat freer at times. So I would say that it really runs the gamut, and that part of what you want to do when you want to match a nonprofit organization with a business is really looking at, again, the values, the goals of each, and what makes sense.
Excellent, excellent. Recently on the sector, we were talking about the different differences for generationals, the millennials, the Gen X, baby boomers, so forth, in the workplace and beyond. So have you found that there's a significant generational difference in support of ESVs and related concepts?
Well, when we look at recruiting top talent, and particularly younger generations, the importance of finding something that is aligned with values is definitely something that is we're seeing as much more important, at least as an intentional item on a checklist when searching for a company to associate with. We also see that all generations, depending on you know what your history is with volunteering, may want to do different kinds of things. And of course, at different ages and stages of our lives, different things are important. So there may be a strong motivation to contribute to the community and to develop skills at a certain point in your life when you're developing your career or when you're making some kind of transition, whereas at another time in your life, you may be interested in contributing in a way that provides you with social connections, especially if you're new to a community. So I think that while there may be some generational differences, what I think is of more significance that we're seeing in employer-supported volunteering is the age and stage of your life and your particular motivations in terms of other things that may be happening in your career.
Oh, interesting. So then, what would you say are some of the challenges for a successful ESV program?
One of the things that's always important when you have a nonprofit organization and a business working together is to understand each other's culture, understand power imbalances that may be perceived or real, and to understand each other's reality. And one of the great things about the Corporate Council on Volunteering that Volunteer Canada has had the pleasure of convening over the last 10 years has been the ability to exchange some of those practices and some of those and how folks are dealing with some of those challenges. And so the notion of building an understanding and building bridges between nonprofits and companies by learning to speak each other's language and appreciate the constraints and the motivations of each really makes for a better relationship. So, for example, if a small organization which has a fairly small staff component is trying to run their program but also plan the logistics for a large number of employees coming to their facility, that the understanding of what the additional resources required and the amount of time needed for planning is important between those two working together. Similarly, if a company is interested in having certain opportunities for skills development, then those need to be put on the table so that the nonprofit could really look at opportunities that can develop those skills and see if that's realistic. So like any good relationship, the more you're able to put your needs on the table, respect each other's assets, and accept and respect the fact that you all bring value to the table, the better the relationship is, and the more you're able to find a program and a project and an activity that meets everybody's needs.
And that's fantastic advice for any nonprofits that are listening right now. Excellent. Well, Paul, let's go on to our weekly feature called Pitch of the Week. And this is where we ask our guests to give us their best elevator pitch for whatever charity or cause that you think is worthy. So imagine you have, you know, the billionaire's attention and they've asked you what you're passionate about. What would you pitch them?
Well, In over 200 communities across Canada, there is a local volunteer center. And volunteer centers are amazing in that they understand what organizations need in terms of volunteers, and they're in touch with the community and all the people who have the energy, the time, and the skills to offer. And they build the capacity of organizations to engage volunteers and provide leadership to people and schools and businesses to really make this happen. So if I were in any community that had a volunteer center and I was looking for a place to invest, a volunteer center would be my choice.
Excellent. Great. So lastly, for Volunteer Canada, if anybody wanted to get involved or learn more about them, what should they do?
Go to volunteer.ca. And if you're an organization wanting to get resources on how to better engage volunteers, you click the tab Engaging Volunteers. If you're an individual looking for ideas on volunteer opportunities, we'll link you to your local volunteer center or the Manulife Get Matched button, which gets you to all kinds of opportunities all around the country. And anything you want to know about volunteering, you can connect with us through info@volunteer.ca. Always happy to hear from you.
All right. Well, Paula, thanks so much for joining us on The Sector, and hopefully we can chat again in the future.
All right. That sounds terrific. Take care. Bye.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Welcome back to The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the role of nonprofit social justice and activism right here on CITR. Well, before the break, we were talking a bit about the recent attacks in Ottawa. One of the things that's horribly ironic about this, given that on Tuesday I was on Radio Free Thinker, which is the radio show podcast discussing skepticism, critical thinking, science. I used to host Radio Freethinker along with my good pal Don McLennigan, and I was back on Radio Freethinker on Tuesday to discuss some recent developments in the atheist skeptics movements. And the topic of terrorism came up, and that was because we were discussing things like Islamophobia and the geopolitic nature of terrorism and violence around the world, which was all spurred on by a viral video that was from the Bill Maher TV show, where Bill Maher was talking with noted atheist and I hesitate to use the word liberal, but I will, atheist and a liberal, Sam Harris. And they got into quite a debate with actor Ben Affleck. And it was all about Islamophobia and the nature of terrorism and violence and religious violence in the world. Now, me and Don have been pretty critical of Sam Harris over the years. We have given him credit where it's due, but we felt that it was important to talk a little bit about the concept of liberalism, as Sam Harris, I think, erroneously and arrogantly points out that liberalism and liberals have this big problem with not recognizing the violence inherent in religion. I think we do. I just think that we approached it in a way that's a bit more tact than Sam Harris does. Anyway, so if you want to listen to that conversation, check out Radio Free Thinker. And if you go to radiofreethinker.com, you can download the latest podcast for that. Well, and as I mentioned, we talked a bit about terrorism on that episode, and now we actually have terrorism happening here in Canada. Now, at the time of recording, Wednesday evening, this is actually the same day as the terrorist attacks occurred. So the amount of information that I have currently is not very complete. So I'm not going to really go into major details. I just thought it'd be interesting to discuss a few of the finer points of the circumstances and how it related to our previous conversation on Tuesday. And a reminder that at the time of recording this, which is Wednesday evening, there's not a lot of new information that's come out, so I don't have up-to-date news to tell you, and I wasn't really going to plan on doing that anyway. There were just a couple of things that I wanted to discuss, again, in relation to what we were talking about on Radio Free Thinker in terms of terrorism, in terms of how we label and define terrorism, and its relationship to the notion of religious extremism. What's interesting about the attacks that occurred today at Parliament Hill, and I was watching the coverage on the news, and I was actually kind of surprised that one of the things that I predicted was that anytime you experience terrorism that seems to come from a local homegrown source, and I think that's what we have here, a local Canadian, we don't understand his motives yet, and again, this we may get more information later in the week as time progresses. But it's not like this person is a foreigner from a different country in Iraq or from the Middle East where there's a ongoing strife going on. This person appears to be homegrown. Now, one of the tendencies is that with a homegrown terrorist, we tend to label these people as maybe extremists or crazy people, lone gunmen, people with an axe to grind, and we don't really think of them in the same way that we think of a terrorist who does the Boston Marathon bombing or 9/11 or something like that. And when we create these separate lines of reasoning for different terrorist acts, we don't really do ourselves a service. We actually make it harder for ourselves to both keep ourselves safe, but also understand why these events happen. And that ultimately is going to limit how we prevent it from happening in the future. One of the things that Don and I were talking about was this notion of how countries like Canada and America and Britain and Western Europe, how we interact with the rest of the world is often reported on in a one-way streak. We often hear about in the news how a terrorist has attacked us or how something bad has happened to our countries. We don't often hear about the effect that we have on other nations. And Don raised a really good point last time, was that, you know, we have soldiers come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. They're dealing with mental conditions from, you know, being in a war zone for 6 months to a year, depending on how long their service is. And, you know, we look after these people. We try to get them the help that they need, but even still, sometimes we're not able to help them, and they, you know, have a rough time coming back and integrating into society. That's not really all that extraordinary. So why would we not expect levels of extremism and levels of what we would consider pretty crazy rhetoric and ideology to emerge in countries that are essentially war zones and have been for the last 10, 15 years? It's really not that surprising when somebody, group of people, whatever, they get together and they resort to a very fundamentalist, extremist worldview and start inflicting violence. We've seen what happens to just a couple of people in a war zone for a short amount of time. It's not surprising that there's going to be extreme responses after extreme exposure. So what's interesting in the news reporting that I saw was that there was actually a lot of willingness to refer to this as terrorism. And there didn't seem to be, at least from what I was watching, a lot to try to kind of force this into a connection to the Middle East or Canada's combat operations in Iraq or Afghanistan, at least from what I saw on the CBC. I only watched a little bit of it, but again, that's something to consider. I mean, it's a good thing that didn't happen. I think that our coverage of the news has been pretty even-handed. And I think Peter Mansbridge did a very good job. I watched his coverage pretty extensively, and he was very reasoned, very calm. And it definitely gave us, I think, a good lens to view the circumstances under. In fact, there's been a bit of discussion on Facebook and Twitter that the Canadian media has done a significantly better job reporting on this tragedy than the way that American news outlets report on a tragedy in America. It's a lot less sensational, and it's a lot less extreme in motivating of fear, and it seems to be more focused on, let's get the facts, let's examine this, let's not make any rash conclusions, et cetera, as opposed to, you know, terrorism in Canada, type stuff. So it's been an interesting experience to look at that and notice that difference. Now, there's one other thing that I wanted to talk about with regards to the attacks in Ottawa, and that's the statement that was put out by Elizabeth May, leader of the Green Party. And this statement, it's an essay that she wrote on the day of the attack, and you can read this online on our website, and we'll have a link to this on our show notes at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. It's a really good essay. It's worth the read. I want to just read out to you one particular quote that I found very, very good, and I'll just read it now. Quote, "We must ensure that this appalling act of violence is not used to justify a disproportionate response. We must not resort to hyperbolic rhetoric. We need to determine if these actions are coordinated to any larger group or are the actions of one or two deranged individuals. If it is the latter, we must develop tools and a systemic approach to dissuade our youth from being attracted to violent extremist groups of any kind. We need to protect our rights and liberties in a democracy." And that's really an important statement, in my opinion. I think it's very nice to have a standout voice that goes against the somewhat, I don't want to use the words nationalistic or patriotic, but sometimes when tragedies happen like this, we feel the urge to overstate the shock, the horror, and the fear that it causes, as opposed to focusing on the elements that are still useful and good about this. You know, we don't want to forget that despite this event happening, there was a system in place that was able to respond to it. So in other words, it's not like we had a total security breakdown. It may seem that way when we look at it, and of course, you know, you see that footage of the shootout in Parliament Hill, but at the same time, the security responded. They took care of the assailant and no one else was hurt. I mean, yes, granted, circumstances could have been different, but we don't want to lose sight of the fact that although there was tragic loss of life, this wasn't a catastrophic failure of security. Security did respond, and could there be more security? Could there be better security designs? Probably yes, there could be, and that those should be implemented. But we don't want to respond and react in a way that's going to involve, you know, metal detectors and bomb-sniffing dogs and robots with guns and, you know, a giant security network system that's going to be expensive and unnecessary and ultimately not even, it's just going to have no real impact. There's always going to be a risk of danger, and we don't want to respond in a way that makes us paranoid and delusional and, you know, afraid to go to work in the morning. So response needs to be tempered. We need to make sure that we understand that we need security, but at the same time, we don't want to go overboard and come up with something that's just extravagant and, you know, crazy and insane. Well, let's just take a quick break here on The Sector. We'll be back with more after this.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that...
CITR!
Can be mighty helpful.
Yeehaw!
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
And we are back here on The Sector on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, your host, discussing the role of nonprofit social justice and activism. So before the break, we had our interview with Paula Spivak of Volunteer Canada, and we were also discussing the recent attacks in Ottawa. And again, just remind everyone, recording at the time of the incident, and so we don't have all the details. By the time this actually goes to air, there'll be more information, so if things are wrong or if there's little details that aren't quite right, do forgive me, but working with limited resources, as you know. Anyway, I wanted to mention, before we wrap up today's show, another disturbing trend in our ongoing series on the CRA and charities here in Canada. Now, listeners are probably aware that we've discussed this multiple times regarding the CRA's crackdown on charities, the audits over political activity. Now, we've discussed in the past what political activity entails. It's a not clearly defined concept, and that charities are supposed to acknowledge how much of their resources they spend on political advocacy, any sort of partisan politics, of course. Now, charities are supposed to report this. They can't go over 10%. And again, what does that 10% mean? Does it mean resources cash? Does it mean resources volunteer time? Does it mean resources public awareness? That's not really all that well defined. So it's up to the CRA to monitor that and make sure that no one is really crossing any particular lines in the sand. Now, we've also pointed out that while this is vaguely defined, it's not necessarily a bad thing in that it allows for some leeway. If it was too rigidly defined, it could actually inhibit charities from doing what we would consider important work in the political arena. Now, the other side of the coin, of course, is that the CRA has been auditing several charities over the last year. Several of these charities are notably left-leaning progressive charities, focusing on things like human rights, civil liberties. And the charities that have been targeted include charities like Amnesty International, among others. So it's been a bit disturbing, and obviously we've devoted a bit of time here on the show to discuss some of the recent reports, some of the accusations. The CRA has maintained that they are politically neutral, that this isn't any kind of targeted charity focus, that this is just a going down the list type thing of charities that have been suspected of not being compliant. Many charities have doubted this publicly. We've also talked about some of the research that's been done. Articles have been written in various newspapers, as well as peer-reviewed articles that have appeared in research papers, documenting this and also examining it under a very critical lens, suggesting that, at the very least, there is some political bias going on here. You can, of course, follow the money, follow the trails, and you do see some familiar names, people who are connected to Canada's oil industry, Canada's resource extraction industries, and you can see a lot of the complaints regarding the compliance to the CRA regulations have also been coming towards environmental charities. And of course, you know, who are they most critical of but resource extraction industries? So there is certainly a connection. And again, if we're going to find that kind of smoking gun, that memo that says, please audit left-leaning charities, that's probably unlikely to come up, but it does raise a lot of questions. Now, speaking of those questions being raised, recently a left-leaning think tank released a report examining the CRA audits. This was done by the Broadbent Institute, and we'll have a link to their research on our show notes. The story was also picked up by the Globe and Mail, among others, and we'll again link to those news stories as well on the website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. The research from the Broadbent Institute looked at the charity records of 10 right-leaning nonprofits and charities, specifically at their reported political activity. All of them were at zero, as in they spent no resources on political activity of any kind. However, they also looked at some of the policy of these right-leaning charities and highlighted several areas where it appears they actually are making very political statements. Now, despite these statements being publicly available, they're public knowledge, they're on Twitter, on Facebook, wherever, in documents and reports, they listed the zero political activity in their reports to the CRA. So it does raise some questions as to why the CRA isn't investigating them as diligently as they are investigating Amnesty International and the David Suzuki Foundation and other environmental charities. To quote right from the actual study itself by the Broadbent Institute, they looked at the various charities. So, for example, Canada Without Poverty, which was audited by the CRA for political activities, their total revenue in 2013 was $377,000. In the 2013 year, they reported that they spent 3% of their resources on political activity, which amounts to about $12,000. In 2012, they spent about 2%, which was around $5,000, and in 2011, they spent about 1%, around $5,000 again. So they were audited by the CRA for political activity. Now, the C.D. Howe Institute, which is a right-leaning think tank, their total revenue for 2013 was $4.9 million. In 2013, they reported zero political activity. They were not audited by the CRA. The David Suzuki Foundation, their total revenue for 2013 was $9.9 million. That's a lot. In 2013, they reported 5% political activity, which was around $400,000. They were audited. The Ecology Action Center, $1.9 million for their total revenue. And in 2013, they reported a 4% political activity budget. They were also audited. So were Environmental Defense, the Ecology Action Center, etc., etc. Jumping down a bit to some of the conservative think tanks, for example, the McDonnell Laurier Institute, which spent their budget is $1.1 million, and in 2013 claimed 0% political activity. They weren't audited. The Fraser Institute, which is quite famous here in BC, they have an annual budget of $8.9 million, and in 2013 claimed zero political activity. They've publicly declined to comment on whether or not they were audited, but I think, well, I mean, the suspicion is that they haven't been, but they have not officially confirmed that. If you look in detail at the report, so for instance, the C.D. Howe Institute, the charity that I mentioned earlier, they reported zero political activity in 2013. Yet, in looking at some of their output, in terms of what their policies have been and some of their papers, we can see that they've actually put out some pretty significant political statements. So, for example, in 2013, a C.D. Howe paper recommends the province of Ontario, quote, insulate implementation agencies from policymakers, meaning that the government should not use ministerial directives to interfere with the day-to-day operation of key power sector institutions. Create a properly designed market for forward generation capacity to enable Ontario to increase reliance on market signals for new investment. replaced the Ontario Power Authority's principal buyer role with a newly created regional intermediaries, often referred to as load-serving entities, that are closer to the customer. Now, that does sound like a lot of gobbledygook market stuff, but that's a fairly political statement, what they're essentially stating there. Now, you can also look in the report at some of the other statements from the CD Howe papers and policies, and there's quite a few of them. It would at least suggest that a small percentage is going into political activity here. And again, looking through the report, you can see examples from the Fraser Institute and other right-leaning think tanks and charities. Now, again, what's interesting about this is that they've all reported zero political activity. And I've said before, I think that there's a couple problems with the political activity compliance issue. First of all, one, it's poorly defined. Two, it's not clear exactly what harm some political activity does, because we allow some of it, we allow 10%. And three, if we're going to have a more rigorous political activity compliance issue, how are we going to define that? And who gets to decide what that limit is? You know, for example, for certain charities, advocacy of any kind can be political. Amnesty International or certain environmental charities need to be political in order to get their point across and fulfill their mandate. So that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, how do we even... Because we're determining the point of a charity at that stage. We're discussing what does it mean to be charitable in Canada if we're going to start discussing how to break down political activity. So that's problematic for all of those reasons. For completely other reasons, it's interesting that the right-leaning charities all reported zero political activity. And again, you can look at the examples like the one that I gave for the Howe charity and say, okay, well, at the very least, that 0% is kind of questionable. Maybe 1%, maybe 2%. Like, again, let's be reasonable. Sure. Maybe they're not the most objectively political statements we've ever seen, but they're a little bit political. And that 0% then doesn't even make a lot of sense. Now, for the environmental charities like the David Suzuki Foundation or the Eco Justice ones or the civil liberties charities, a lot of them have reported, honestly, that they do have political activity, 5%, 6%, whatever. That information is publicly available, that anyone can go and get that information if they want. It's online, it's required by the CRA to be findable so that people who want to donate can go and find that information and say, oh, I see, this foundation, they do devote, 6%, and that comes out to be maybe $30,000. That's a question that the donor has to ask themselves before they make a donation, but that's how it's supposed to be. So we have on one hand charities who have reported, honestly, some political activity below the threshold of the CRA limit. They're being audited. Then you have these other charities who have stated 0% political activity for multiple years, with questionable statements that could be considered political, and they have not been audited. So the conclusion is, well, somebody's lying. I mean, they have to be, right? At this stage, there's something fishy going on. I think that that's somewhat reasonable to suggest, correct? I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe I'm not seeing this 100%. And if that's the case, I urge you to... correct me, email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can follow up on our show notes as well as get the podcast at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at sectorpodcast. You can also follow us on Twitter, sectorpodcast, or follow me, Ethan Clow, at Ethan Clow on Twitter. Well, we're going to wrap up the show today as we're running out of time. Great content today. Our thanks to Paul Spivak for joining us from Volunteer Canada. One of the last things that I want to mention is that I'll be hosting a panel on the CRA charity audits. The event in question is called Charities Under Threat, Responding to Federal Charity Bashing and CRA Audits. It's taking place Thursday, November 13th, at 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Hyatt Vancouver, which is at 210-128 West Hastings Street in downtown Vancouver. The event is hosted by NetSquared Vancouver, which is a online technology nonprofit meetup group that sponsors various technology-related, nonprofit-related, interesting events and discussion groups. So it should be really fantastic. Again, as it's happening on Thursday, November 13th. Now, I will be hosting the panel, and the panel features some really interesting speakers. So, for example, we have Margaret Mason, a charity lawyer, one of Canada's leading lawyers for charitable and not-for-profit organizations. We also have Gareth Kirby, who is a researcher and professional communicator. Gareth was the one who initially wrote up in his thesis statement the nonprofit charity audits that were going on by the CRA. So he'll be able to discuss in detail his research and what he uncovered in looking at the CRA and the charity audits that were going on. So we'll mention this some more as we get closer to the date. And again, we will have the links to the Facebook event and the meetup event on our show notes, so you can go check out and RSVP to them and hopefully see you there. Well, we are running out of time on today's episode of The Sector. This has been episode 25, and our thanks for tuning in and listening live or via podcast. And our thanks to Paul Spivak for joining us from Volunteer Canada. Again, we will have all of the links and show notes available at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And we will talk next week, same time, same place. We all want to change the world. Tell me that it's evolution. Up on the roof with Robin.